welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back to that same old place that you laughed about. Well, the names have all changed since you hung around, but those dreams have remained and they've turned around. Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Back here where we need ya.
Back here where we need ya.
Yeah, they tease him a lot, 'cause we got him on the spot. Welcome back.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back.
Oh my God! Okay, well, there's that's in there. We're keeping it.
You got to keep the classics. If you got some Mel Brooks going on, you got to hang on to it.
You got to keep the Mel Brooks. By the way, this is Hey Kids Comics, everybody. I'm Andrew Farmer. That's Cole Houston. We're a little punchy tonight. I was speaking of Mel Brooks. I was talking about the first comedy. I was reliving I recently recorded an interview with Cole for the 4th of July.
The first time ever I saw Star Wars.
Right, and I was talking about the first time, and of course I ran gangbusters over it and claimed all three movies.
That's right. You owned the entire franchise.
Yeah, I owned every iteration. But I was talking about the first comedy I ever saw, and the first comedy, I think we talked about this on the United States of Geekdom, but the first comedy I ever saw was Blazing Saddles at the age of about three. So that explains so much about me.
And that's I'm actually sort of retro jealous, because Blazing Saddles was actually fairly heavily advertised on television at a time where it wasn't like today, where you get a commercial for a movie, you're like, oh, I can't wait to go see that 3.5 months from now, apparently.
Right.
And I was like, I so had to see this movie, and it so put Dad in the position of having to explain that you're not going to see this damn movie.
Right.
it's not all Alex Karras punching a horse. It's there's things you don't really need to be seeing at your age, unless you're Andrew and are considerably younger.
Right, and it makes no sense to you anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
By the way, when your time comes, Cole. When your time comes, and it comes for all of us, yes. I'm going to petition for your tombstone to say life ellipsis, right? It's not all Alex Karras punching a horse. That's what's going on there.
I could actually get behind that. If nothing else, just as a fitting epitaph in any form, it's just because it's terribly expensive to put out an obituary nowadays.
Yeah.
If they don't have any minimum... Just that's enough.
That's enough.
Cost you $60-$80 for that alone, but that's fine. I'm happy with it. I'll be dead.
By the way, we do a comic book show. We should probably start the show at some point. Cole, why don't you tell people
grim topic for a moment?
Why don't you tell people what we're going to talk about tonight?
Inevitable demise of my mortality being thrust into my face by my co-host.
Hey, you're going to live forever in my heart. So, and I'm going to live forever because I'm a weird comedy vampire. I drink it in.
And may you do so, that we may always occasionally get to the point of a comic book show. So yes, indeed, this is Hey Kid, the comics, number 187, Salon de Refuser. And I'm sure genuinely, legitimately French-speaking persons of French or French-Canadian origins.
Possibly Creole.
Even Creole. Let us not leave them out. Or just scholars who are not...
Michael Price, who I'm sure speaks fluent French on top of everything else.
With apologies to my Afro-Canadian friend Richard, who speaks probably more fluent French than he admits. I probably butchered everything but salon. Insofar as the pronunciation, because while I did do some research on the actual 1867 Salon de Refuser, I did not do any research on the accurate pronunciation thereof. And if my memory serves me, from 1980 some odd. It was Salon des Refusés.
So what is that?
So either my memory is faulty, or I had a really piss poor art history survey, which I think I'm going to go more for the former, the piss poor memory, old man brain, because number one, he was the chairman of the department, and number two, he gave me an A on a semester paper that I wrote over the course of 9 hours. 9.5 hours before it was due.
Well, there you go. There you go.
In due deference to that, the Salon des Refusés of 1863.
Ooh. We're getting classy up in this joint tonight.
Occasionally, we ourselves can manage to do that without any help from scholars who we bring in on the sly by tricking them, thinking, oh, it's just a funny book show. And then we force them to be smart on our behalf.
Right.
Because we're like the pack lids in Next Generation.
We trick them into being smart.
That's right. I want to be smart. We just kidnapped Jordy LaForge to do all our work for us.
That's right.
So at the Palais de l'Industrie, again, the butchery of the French language, one of the Romance languages turned in a guttural form into pornography. It was basically this was the locale where the annual salon, or to translate quite literally, the French, it's French for exhibition, I think, or French for gallery, I forget now which, because I actually did bother to read some of this crap, but just to refresh my memory. But in Napoleonic France, the previously aforementioned Palace Day industry. That's my –
A Palace Day industry. It's one of them.
The Academy of Fine Arts, which thankfully was not spelled out in French, the Paris Salon was basically this annual showcase of the best art by academia. So it was just very stodgy, idealized, very much what, you know, conservative artwork that would fit a specific mold of its day.
Right.
You know, they didn't want anybody rushing off and trying to start their own movements. That was right out. We'd have none of that. But to have your work showcased in the salon was a huge deal for an artist. That meant the aristocracy and the hoi polloi came around and flocked and observed and pontificated in front of your stuff, and which changes the flavor of that sentence drastically. They pontificate in front of your stuff.
So, I like the roller coaster that you take us on, Cole.
This is a wonderful little bell curve of the language here. But, you know, this was where you would get your commissions and your patronage and, even Emperor Napoleon III would go and select, you know, the artists that would be given the sort of royal, the imperial commissions. And in 1863, apparently the jury of the Salon that year were just so full of themselves, they completely rejected 2/3 of the paintings presented.
Wow.
Including works by Manet, Pissarro. Oh. I mean, people who are pontificated over their stuff to this day.
Right. Their stuff is widely pontificated.
It's so pontificated upon that they had to put it behind a plexiglass screen. Expose yourself to art. No, that's not what we meant, sir. So, essentially, the Salon des Refusés was literally like the answer to this just ridiculously narrowly defined kind of approach, or this you know, dismissal of so much fine art, to the point where, you know, it reached the ears of the emperor himself, who, despite his own taste, felt like, oh, you know, I still have to be – I do have a public. I do have a people over whom I rule. So they basically arranged in the same, you know, under the same hallowed roof to have an exhibition of what were 2/3 of the presented artwork.
Nice.
And you have to imagine of that one third that didn't get refused outright, that, you know, some of it, some of that third didn't make the final cut.
Right.
And, you know, there are so many, there were, are some works that I'd seen cited that are, you know, famous ones you would know on site that were among the Salon des Refusés. So I got to thinking about that because somehow my university education started catching up to me. And, you know, every now and again, it when I'm trying to conjure up fart jokes, I get, like, really thoughtful things. And I got to think, you know, why don't we exhibit, as it were, in our gallery of the mind, a collection of works that are forgotten, ignored, or largely unknown.
See, I love it. I think it's great.
That you might want to seek out. And, you know, and that works in any language, frankly. And again, with sincere apologies to all French-speaking persons worldwide, we now present you with our...
That's right. So, where do you want to start with this? Because there's so many that...
I want to bring up off the bat, because this is the most tremendous of long shots. Even Longshot himself, tremendous long shot. But decades ago, when Catherine and I, when Mr. Jedi Cole and I were first going and selling at conventions, it was at the indie publisher was on the cusp of hitting.
Yeah.
An industry in its own right. And I remember seeing this very high-profile group of guys selling comics and just, you know, people coming over and just flocking to what they had and talking to them. And they were the people everyone wanted to talk to about comics, or seemed, among the vendor room. And on the wall, I think that's the only thing on this little split, this little tiny piece of wall beside their tables, they had hung this comic book called The Clock.
The Clock.
And there was a skeletal figure, perhaps the Grim Reaper, I'm not really certain. And they had a little handwritten sign, "Ask me about this comic." To this day, I cannot find anything about this comic. So I want to start with, it may be one of the most amazing gems to be discovered out there. It may have been absolute abject crap. But I am curious beyond words about The Clock.
Okay, so I'm going on record right now. I'm writing it down, The Clock. At some point in our future, we will have an episode. It's not going to be this month. It's not going to be 6 months from now. But we will have an episode on the comic book, The Clock.
Yeah, and I think the biggest problem, and I want to forewarn people, if you're going to try to, like, oh, I'll help out, I'll be Captain Google. If you look up The Clock, there was apparently a comic book character called The Clock. That's not The Clock I'm looking for.
Did you just get like Dead Man Boston branded by Shatner when no one was looking? I feel like
I may well have. This is not The Clock we are looking for here. We want the 80s independent comic The Clock.
I'm going to go on record to say that either Christopher Walken or William Shatner, if they ever do a live-action version of Deadman, needs to play that character.
Oh, God. Yes, I think Walken would be...
Because you don't have to... The character obviously would have to be CG. Because he doesn't exist.
Yeah,
he's an apparition.
I think Walken would be... That's absolutely inspired, brilliant casting. Because I could see Walken... I wish I could convey to you how... God, that was like...
You slid right into Shatner.
That was
you
like Walken Shatner.
Yeah. That's like a Bader Meinhof, the Walken Shatner postulate.
Why Walken Shatner?
But in my mind, it makes absolute sense. Yeah,
I think absolutely.
Yeah, because you would instantly know who Boston Brand was inhabiting, because they would be, you know, walkening it up.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So it would be complete. It would be instantly obvious that was not that character
on the set to run through all of the possessed.
Oh yeah.
Stuff, and then that way the actor has a feel of exactly how to be that character. So, you know, about that same period, there was a black and white indie that I did see called Heroes, and that was an interesting. I think I was able to obtain a couple of issues, because back then, you know, nobody was carrying these indies. If you wanted an indie, and that's literally why Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles #1 is so much sought after, because you had to be there where the guys that were writing and drawing and publishing it were showing up at conventions on their own dime.
Right, right.
So, and that was the case with this one, where the creators were there, and they're just like, you know, please buy my comic. Like two copies away from a Big Mac. And which probably does a disservice. Those guys probably did pretty well, because they actually did make it into comic shops for a while, because I actually used to have in my collection a poster, a store poster for Heroes.
Okay.
Had their logo and silhouettes of all the characters. And it was a really good, legitimate attempt to humanize the superhero genre before Watchmen.
Or okay.
At least around the same time, to the point where apparently they weren't terribly afraid to have at least partially implicit, partially more than just hinted at sex scene with their Mr. Fantastic stretching type character. Apparently some Mr. Fantastics are more fantastic than others.
Well, it's one of those things where, depending on how old you are when you're creating these comics, you don't know the line in the sand that says don't make this. There's a reason that they haven't ever shown us that, you know.
This kind of proved that, it you know, depending on your superhero set, your particular powers,
right,
it could be both the size of the boat and the motion of the ocean. Just put that out there. But if you could ever come,
sorry. Oh, that was good. That was good. That was good. That's the joke so far. I like it. Well played, sir. Well played. Oh my God, that was good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, who wrote this, Brody Bruce? The thing is, this dork made of orange rocks too. It's a superhero secret.
Oh my God! Yeah. So, I mean, but there were so many. But you're okay. So you're absolutely right that there were so many great books out there in a period of time when now somehow they were in the perfect, because comic historians, if you go online and you search for, they will give you like a Justice Society of America golden age play by play of every issue. You can find reviews of every issue of those comic books online. You can also find every, you know, play by play rundowns of every issue of current comic books online. But there seems to be a weird sweet spot there that people that is widely ignored.
Yeah.
And you know, you had
there's
lot of
vacuum.
Books back then.
There is a complete and total informational vacuum because of comics that existed in a time before the prevalence of the internet and didn't exist in a large enough way for anyone to give a damn.
Right.
To try to find them. And I would, you know, if God forbid any former comic creators out there ever happen to listen to this show, introduce the world to your work today, because nobody else is doing it.
Right. I agree. Like for instance, I'm holding an issue of one of my favorite comics, and it was a weird indie by Caliber. Do you remember Caliber?
Oh yes.
That had a fairly impressive print run. Okay, so it was fairly large, but I still to this day can't find very much on it. It's a black and white comic, color cover, but black and white comic by Jay Geldof called The Lost. Did you ever hear about The Lost?
The name rings incredibly familiar.
It's one of those comics that on the inside of the thing, there's that's dedicated to Pam Grier. I don't know why it's
or actually to fit the theme here, the inside of the stuff.
But yeah, and it's but the one of the reasons I picked it up was I picked it up at Mid Ohio Comic Con. God, I don't know when. Is there a release date on this comic? Because I picked 96. So it was 96. So, you know, that would have been right after I graduated high school. I picked it up. It's a brilliant work. It's a brilliant retelling of Peter Pan, where Peter Pan is and the Lost Boys are vampires.
Okay, yes. I remember that. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and it's, you know, they live in the seedy underbelly of whatever town they live in, but it's kind of a horror retelling. But it is very reminiscent of like a Neil Gaiman type telling of a story, and I love it, but you cannot find anything on it anywhere because I have I have two issues, and I think that they're I think they went to 10, but I can't find any other issues of it. And I implore you, if you can get your hands on it, read it because it's super fun. But there's other things that. So where did you? Okay, so as a up and coming comic reader, where did you get your? Because you're much like our readers of today, people are sort of introduced to comic book characters by what's being released in new comics. You know, that's pretty much it. There wasn't much of a way to get at any of the history and anything that's good in comics. So where did you find your favorite comics comic characters that you never knew existed?
Oh, that's, you know, it's interesting you mention that because I'm probably wrong. It was either Amazing Heroes or one of the other magazines that was out at the time. And there were a couple that I don't remember really the name. But in the 80s, you didn't have information at your fingertips.
Right.
And much like the information you have at your fingertips, I always have to remind people today, if anything's on the internet, it's because someone bothered to put it there.
Right.
It is not the infinite instant ask me anything Oracle / Library of Alexandria that people to this day seem to think it is. If something's there, it's because someone put it there.
Right.
In some form or fashion. And in our way, that's what we do with this show, is we're putting stuff there.
Right.
And, you know, before then, it was, like I said, Amazing Heroes or one of these other magazines published one year this massive, like, you know, 100-and-something page magazine. And it was just, you know, like pica font, list after list after list of hundreds of comic titles you had never heard of. Hundreds you'd heard of.
Right.
Hundreds you were aware of. And hundreds you'd never heard of. It was literally the repository of its day. I wish I still had that. Because the thing was practically falling apart. I'd read it so much. Because not only did it say, you know, just like Commandy, it said Commandy, you know, classic. There would be a whole write-up on it.
Yeah, little,
yeah. It inspired you to seek this damn thing out. And I found out about so many titles because of it. Some of them you could find the back issues. Some of them you couldn't. And some of them was stuff that, you know, until publishers bothered reprinting the old stuff, chances are you missed out on it before you were born.
Right, right, right.
Unless you're like a comic historian with these cotton gloves and this climate-controlled archive who's allowed to come in and have someone turn the pages for you, you're never going to know these stories. But it was fascinating stuff because it opened the door to so much. And I'm actually racking my brain to remember some of the titles that I sought out because of it. And the other place you came upon, once you really wanted to find something new, I remember at some point in the late 80s, Catherine and I were, it was the weirdest thing. It was like this little restaurant in some little town, and I couldn't tell you where the hell we were. But we were somewhere in Texas, almost certainly, and we walked into this little restaurant, and at the back of the restaurant was a tiny little comic shop.
That's awesome!
And I'm like, damn it, I would so want that. That was the most brilliant thing ever. It was just like this extra space they had available, and the guy was able to get it for a song and maintain this little temper, you know, this little tiny pop-up in the days before pop-ups.
Right.
And it just had, you know, a bunch of long boxes of comics and some other stuff there. And we're rifling through, and I found all but maybe one or two issues of Jim Sturm's amazing The Serial Killings.
Okay, okay.
And that's C-E-R-E-A-L.
Right, right.
And if you get a chance, track these down. I don't know that they were ever collected. I think he was a contributor. There was actually, of all things, a magazine that was published at the time, which is advertised in his book. Actually, I stand corrected. This was from the 90s. There was a magazine for cereal box collectors called Flake.
What?
And I don't know how many of them took offense to that. It's perhaps a description of themselves, but, you know, I think most of them probably realize they're talking about the form in which many cereals are found. But, and I suspect that a lot of people found The Serial Killings through ads in Flake. they probably had a cooperative going on, you know, where they would promote each other. And, like, the first issue of the Serial Killings, there's some backup stuff.
Okay.
Because I don't know that they felt it could carry. And then after a while, the story pretty much took over completely.
That's great.
And what's fascinating about it is you don't have to be a cereal box collector and know the history of the cereal mascots.
Right.
Many of which were, you know, they would just come up with some kind of cereal. They'd come up with the shape, the size, the form, everything about it. And then the promotional department would then be approached. They go, what do you want to attach to this? A monkey or a lion or a monster or what have you? Interesting enough, a little fun fact on cereal, and I will move on, is that Cap'n Crunch is unique in having been the cart before the horse.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, the studio that created Rocky and Bullwinkle was approached to come up with a mascot for cereal. Then they'd worry about the cereal later. And that, my friends, is where we get Captain Horatio Crunch.
Really?
And that is actually his name, Horatio Crunch.
Horatio Crunch.
And the reason old Horatio fits into this is I believe that one of the principal character through whom the story is told in Serial Killings is a cereal company executive who works for the sole surviving. There are so many analogs in this that it's obvious this character is the sole surviving Rice Krispies elf.
This is like Fables before Fables.
Exactly. This was like Fables for modern bullshit.
Right, for optics and marketing, yeah. And yeah.
It really was, because, you know, Snip the Elf runs this giant Kelcog, I think was actually the name of it, if I may be mistaken there, but and it's all of these characters, like this, you know, this drunken elephant who's an executive and a belligerent rabbit and, you know, a retired clown, and the story circulating around an independent cereal producer who was a scarecrow, who his cereal gets folded into their brand and he slowly becomes more and more marginalized.
Oh, it was also a Trieste against the indie comics industry and the big two as well, I'm sure.
I think so. But it also was, you know, very much the way big industries use and grind under their own weight the very things that, you know, bring them to the height of their power.
Right.
You're only as important as when you're bringing them money, and then. And then, of course, there's just some wonderful things like like Doug the Frog, there was like a obvious some kind of vulture-looking creature that I think was supposed to be the Cocoa Puffs cuckoo, who's diabetic but hooked on his own cereal.
Right.
And Doug the Frog, who was in his prime as a spokesmodel, as it were, but in his old age just is a bloated old nobody. And it's a fascinating story, full of intrigues and corporate, insider theft and scapegoating. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really just this wonderfully human story told through a bunch of funny animals. But the principal character, I think, is meant to be the grown up boy from Captain Crunch's questionable crew. You know, shanghaied a couple of small children and an elephant and an anthropomorphic dog and set to sea, spreading his sugary goodness.
See, for me, you had those are your experience. For me, and keep in mind, now you can go on to, you know, any of your various, which we do for this show. Don't think that we don't, but your Comic Vines or your BuzzFeeds and find lists of. You know, if I'm doing research for this particular show, I look for underutilized or misrepresented comic book characters, and you can find just lists of people posting and everything.
Yeah.
You know, but that's, again, subjective, other people's opinions. When, you know, in my day, when I was getting started, and keep in mind, Cole was about, what, 10 years before me, even, in comics, and we're both old, so it's fine. But, you know, so Cole had his experiences. Mine were what I did when I wanted to find, and I implore anyone that's out there to do this to this day, And I know Cole has, because Cole will tell you a story as soon as I'm done with this that will blow your mind. And I think he's probably talked about it on the show, but it's one of my favorite things that Cole does, and I love everything that Cole does, so this has to be special. But when you wanted to find out, when you wanted more knowledge about comic books, outside of what you were seeing in the pages of whatever you were reading at that point in time, Avengers West Coast or whatever it was, Marvel and DC were kind enough and had apparently the liquid assets to just do this, was they released comics like Who's Who and the official handbook to the Marvel Universe. So what I would do is just go buy, and I pulled a couple issues, but I would just go buy these things at half-price books or wherever and just read them and study them as if it were, you know, as if it were, you know, class, as if it were school, as if I had an exam on it. But you can, like for instance, I just cracked open a Who's Who date update for 1988 Volume 3 that I pulled out of my collection.
Oh, the updates.
That has,
because then you often weren't sure where to put them. And
right, that has the Red Trinity in it, the Secret Six, things like the characters that you had never, ever heard of. Shrapnel, who fought a Robot Man in Doom Patrol. All these things will come back into your brain that you never either you were like, you're like, who the hell? And then you'll study them. Speed McGee, one of my favorite speedsters, and if we can find a picture of Speed McGee to put on this,
we'll definitely try to get Speed McGee, and I'll be making a note here now to look for Speed McGee,
because it's ridiculous. The art that they have for Speed McGee, which is Greg LaRocque, his Speed McGee art is fantastic. But you would go through and you would find these things and read them and learn so much about characters that you had no idea. You go buy those comics.
And those characters will stick with you in odd ways. This weekend I was at the North Texas Comic Book Show, and a vendor friend of mine was showing me, he had someone come in with 3 pages of original DC Comics art.
Wow.
Asking if he was interested. And I had noticed at his table he actually had on display a couple of pages of, believe it or not, Fawcett Captain Marvel.
Oh.
Original art. And it was just insane to look at that. But he was telling me, so this guy came and says, well, he's like, well, what do you want for it? He goes, well, I'm trying to get $20. And he's like, you know, done. And then the guy wound up, he's like, oh, I'm probably just going to give this right back to you, and bought some at his table. So it was effectively like he had made a really sweet trade. And he was showing me these pages. And, you know, one of them at the top, the off-panel section of the blue line pages, I saw immediately, I zeroed in on JLQ. I said, well, what you got there is Justice League Quarterly, number 4, page 18. Or whatever it was, because I knew how to read the code at the top. And, in fact, I got looking at the top panel, and it was here. I said, well, there's Captain Atom. And that, because he was saying, well, they're mentioning, somebody says the Ray. I said, well, that's the Ray right there. And there's Captain Atom. I don't know who that is because it's not in color.
Yeah, it could be anybody.
Yeah, I'm not sure who she is, but she's probably important. And that, I think, comes exactly from what you're talking about. Is there was a time when, you know, there weren't Wicca this and Wicca that.
Right, right.
And you're, you know, when I was in high school, the first Marvel Universe and Who's Who came out, because that was a period where both companies, there was this, you know, industrial espionage zeitgeist going on where,
right,
you know, what are you doing? I'm happening to be doing the same thing, maybe by coincidence.
That Dead Man Walking, was it not Rashomon, but Yojimbo, like, playing both sides against the middle. They're both sitting in their ivory towers across the street from each other, like,
exactly.
Binoculars. Like, what are you doing over there?
What's Shooter up to? Damn it!
Coke. Lots of Coke. That's what Shooter was up to.
When the dust settles, tell me what's going on over there.
Well done.
It's like a snow globe in that office. What the hell? Poor Julie Schwartz is like, what the hell? It's like a snow globe. I have no idea. Apologies to anyone who met the man who was a legend in the comics industry. I have no idea what Julia Schwartz sounded like.
Sounds like something he'd say. Sounds like something he'd say.
Something he would say, but I don't know what he would sound like when he said it. For all I know, he sounded just like Groucho Marx.
And as evidenced by the impression that you just did.
Or Mel Brooks. Or,
so
or perhaps he didn't sound at all Jewish. I don't know.
What,
but anyway.
Go, yeah, go.
But yeah, at simultaneously, Marvel Universe and Who's Who were coming out, and you got this wealth of information about characters you didn't know you cared about, and suddenly you wanted to know about Andro, the cave boy from DC, or you wanted to, you kind of wondered, how come Razorback got remanded to just the print stuff at the back, the guys they weren't going to invest in somebody drawing?
Just the text lines, yeah.
Maybe I want to see a guy who's has a remote-controlled semi-tractor trailer.
Later,
I did find out why you didn't see him.
Why is that?
Because he looks ridiculous.
He does look ridiculous, but I would love to see him come back in something. At this point, like, that's a character. You said Razorback, and immediately it was like an LSD trip flashback. Like, the gates somewhere in my brain opened, and I saw him. You know,
you saw somebody like it was this exaggerated version of one of those anime hoodies, except that it's like stuffed. You know, it's like a plush toy hoodie.
Yes, yeah.
Where your face is coming out like that Finn kid in, was it Adventure Time?
Yes.
Thing? I don't know what your kids are watching.
Kids are watching.
But it's like that thing with the kid and his dog and some creepy old ice wizard. I don't know what the hell. But anyway. Strangely, I know more than I should.
The plot to my favorite Woody Allen movie.
I don't know anything about this, but it's there, and I know more than I should, and I don't understand why I know anything about something I care nothing about, but I know so much, but yet I know nothing.
Hey, so, Larry David called. He just wanted to say
Woody
hi.
Allen's Adventure Time.
Yeah,
right here.
Woody Allen's Adventure Time. Any of our friends that are listening that can draw comics, please.
Yeah,
Woody Allen Adventure Time.
Give us Woody Allen's Adventure Time. But you know, imagine that sort of thing. Like, instead of like little ears, it's just like the entire head of a warthog or a razorback pig in blue, or no, actually in brown, but with a blue tunic, and you know, the guy's like a yard wide, and it's kind of frightening because he's supposed to be like a trucker.
Yes, yeah.
It's like the reject from US-1.
He should have been the villain in US-1.
You're not endorsing US-1 on this show, by the way, but
I not yet. Give me three more shows, and I'll give you a ringing endorsement for US-1.
But you know, he's supposed to be a trucker, but I guess he just kind of has to crouch down in the cab to get all that headgear in there.
Right. Like, how does he get in the truck with all that on his head?
It's like Carmen Miranda as a trucker, you know?
Damn it, Cole. I've never... This is Eric Stoltz in mask.
There's pineapples everywhere.
Oh, now I'm never going to be able to shake that. I'm never going to be able to shake Kris Kristofferson looking stage right and be like, I can't even fit in this damn truck anymore. And then Carmen Miranda sitting next to him like, coochie, just fruit everywhere. Fruit and frilly arms.
What the hell? He's like sits on a pineapple in the cutscene from Convoy.
It's damn it! It's perfect.
Suddenly, Convoy became Cannonball Run.
That, yeah, it became Rat Racer.
It's a living
Gumball Rally or whatever that movie was with Dean Martin, and I can't remember the. Damn it, my brain's not working, but it's okay.
But yeah, that was also. I'm guessing you were invoking the fact that my younger brother and I were simultaneously collecting Marvel Universe, and he bequeathed me his copies up to that point. And in answer to the question to myself of what am I going to do with two copies, I started carrying them around to conventions and have some. I'm very fortunate that Dave Cockrum lived locally, because everything he did for Marvel Universe I had signed before he passed away. I was able to get, and he's still with us, thankfully, but Kerry Gamille, who was also a local boy. And a friend of mine and I got in a very lively conversation with one of the Marvel editors who all of a sudden, Mike Carlin.
Okay.
Back when editors were somebody you would bring to a convention. Like, you know, patently ignored there. But we got to talking to him, and I got curious about why in the back of Who's Who, or of Marvel Universe, in the Alien Races section, all the art looked like it was by different artists.
Right.
But the credit was given in all caps to Pat, what we thought was Patty, P-A-T-Y. And he goes, oh, that's Patty. That's Patty Cockrum, Dave's wife. Like, oh, yeah, of course, Patty. How did I not make that connection? Like, because I don't know who the hell that is. And he said that they were, in fact, all done by different artists. Because some of them look like Byrne.
Right, right.
Some of them look like Cockrum. Some of them look like any number of other creators of the day. And he said, yeah, I drew a few of them myself. And he went through and meticulously found all of his and signed them.
So cool. That's
including
so
the,
cool.
The Seagramites.
Which is still the best.
These miniseries, which were the little snail-like brewmeisters who helped at least drink Galactus under the table. And I asked him if he would please, and it's beautifully preserved there to this day. I had to explain to him what I meant, because he didn't quite catch it at first, but he actually added a little word bubble of the Seagramite going, hick!
That's so good. And that's such... See, here's what I'm saying, is that's such a brilliant idea, because a lot of these books, like if I'm looking through Who's Who in DC, right? And remember, 88, right?
Yeah.
I'm finding a lot of art. I find some art that was Jerry Ordway's art. I find some art that was Mike Harlan's art. I just flipped to a page. Yeah, you find some art that...
You can find a little bit of Michael Golden. You can find a little bit of Creator Fables, all of a sudden. Bill Willingham.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, I'm on a page right here. This was 88, so do the math on this, right? Almost 20 years ago. More than 20. Almost 30 years ago, right? No, almost... I can't do math. But here's copy art, because a lot of this was copy art. A lot of this was somebody was tasked with the job. Some intern or some first year was tasked with the job of drawing these characters. So here is the Silver Banshee as drawn by Mike Mingola. Here's so that Shrapnel was drawn by Eric Larson of later of Savage Dragon fame.
Oh my god.
You know, so all keep in mind, you go back through these and a lot of these aren't the artists that originally do it. These are, you know, first year intern type artists that were given the task that you can now go and get these things signed. Here's a Rob Liefeld in 88 Punchin' Julie.
It's fascinating to find. And then a lot of the high profile artists were involved as well, depending on the profile of the character.
Right.
George Perez very graciously, because on this particular day at Wizard World Texas, almost no one was in the room, but he very graciously signed every single page with his work on it. And I think he greatly appreciated the fact that I would bring these to him about 7 or 8 at a time.
And it's...
So you're talking about like 30 pieces of work.
Right.
But I didn't like, there you go, sir.
But they've now collected these. I don't know about the DC, but I know the Marvel have created omnibus for all of their Marvel Universe books.
And bear in mind, if you're looking for Marvel Universe, look for the original 80s, 90s one, because during the 90s, they re-released the Marvel Universe as a ring. The big thing was ring binder. Who's Who was
In
these ring binder formats, which is highly annoying, but it allowed them to jump all over the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
That was the idea. But it also was a period where some of the characters I didn't care about. I hated the way the Legion was being portrayed at the time.
Right.
And that's when they were all going by their actual names. And, you know, I didn't care about, can't remember their names because I didn't care. But, it was also during the Ringbinder period, I believe, that Marvel decided what we need is a three-around, is to do a turnaround instead of having... So it's the most boring, droll artwork by a single artist.
Mm-hmm.
Every single character is done in a turnaround. So you have a front, a back, and one side view, in a profile view.
Right, right.
And it's dreadful. It's the most awful... I guess they decided what kids want is a sample, like an art sample.
Right, they want a biological survey of this character.
Well, they want to be able to have the turnaround so they can know every angle and they can draw their own art.
And then you can sue them for it later. So
exactly. So
who's really to blame, Marvel? Who's really to blame for all of your fan art that you...
I'm glad you brought up Who's Who and Marvel Universe, because they are sort of a forgotten, not only for a chance to really see some amazing artwork, and some really bad art that belongs in the refuse pile. But also one of the fascinating things is you can go and see, like, Rip Hunter, first appearance was this.
Right.
Shrapnel, first appearance was this. And you can discover a lot of titles you may not have been aware of or become interested in characters. That, and like we talked about on The Doctor Is In, you know, Dr. Demonicus first appeared in Godzilla, but because the character Godzilla wasn't owned by Marvel, but Marvel owned everything they put into the books.
Yeah.
Except Godzilla. Dr. Demonicus also fought the Shogun Warriors. Again, not owned by Marvel, but they brought their own guys in. And then would later go on to fight the Avengers and other... He became a proper character in the Marvel mm-hmm. Universe. So it's a fascinating way to jump off into these characters as well, into some of these titles you may not be aware of.
And it,
or pick up on storylines because of the writer.
Right, right. And for me, it was a big deal to... If I saw a character in a comic, I would look him up in the Marvel Universe thing, right? Just to see... And then I spent so much time just reading origin stories and reading, you know, the storylines and what happened to these characters that it really invested me in learning more and picking up those books. So I think it's a really smart move for Marvel and DC to do this. And I also think that it spoke to a non-internet period of time when they could have very, you know, it just this side of microfiche.
Yes, indeed.
And it's a nerdy pursuit, but at the time, we were the nerdiest of the nerds, so it made absolute sense that some editor in some in some office somewhere was like, well, why don't we just put them all together in a big encyclopedia that people can go look up? And it's like, yeah, and we were all like. I remember the first one I found was like, holy shit, what did I find? Like, I'm flipping through, I'm like, who is this? Who? How did he meet him? He was in that group? When was he in that group? I only know these, and you go down the rabbit hole, and it's so, so cool. And there's another jumping off point from this that I think deserves its entire own episode, but that was, I found a lot of comic book characters in parody comics that were released by Marvel and DC as well. So
I'm glad you mentioned parody, because I wanted to touch upon one thing very briefly on the subject of the character guides like Who's Who in Marvel Universe, because a parody comic was published by God Knows Who that was titled, let me see if I get this right, it was Guide to a Non-Existent Universe.
Okay.
Serves. And the idea was, it was basically them poking fun at these guidebooks.
Okay, that's cool.
With characters like this one character who's like, just is this exploded, like, arms and legs and organs and everything are just flying out every day. It was Pull Yourself Together Man.
Somebody had fun with that. Somebody was sitting on that for a while.
And there would be write-ups on them as well, like the write-up for Grow Arm Hair Lad. Discover to grow enormous amounts of hair off of his arm, so he has these like long locks coming off of
like
his
Medusa
forearm. and he has his costume has like a little holster for a one of those like Norelco 3 circular blade razors. Talks about how he borrows his dad's razor because he figures maybe if he needs to, he could like shave off a section of the hair to make ropes or something with. Just to have in case he needs it type of thing.
Sure.
And he convinces his mom to and it was amazing. I'm doing this from memory because this one's stuck in my head.
You can't get rid of it.
Convinces his mom to sew a costume for him that has GAHL. That he tells her it's for a play for something called, like, I forget, I think it was something like Ginger's Amazing Heavy Lips or something like that. But it's, he basically has this clandestine approach to getting a grow arm hair lad tunic put together for him by his mom. So then this lying little thief goes out to fight crime.
That's fantastic.
And it was all kinds of stuff like that. And there's one where the book ending of these two characters. Name it initially reads as Mr. and Miss Meanerfit. Then when you read the writer, oh, I see. It's supposed to be Miss Fit and Mr. Meaner.
Mr. Meaner, yeah. But when you read them together, because it's Mr. and Mrs.
Well, because of the way they put the two names together on the page with them at opposing corners of the page.
That's awesome.
It read like Miss Meanerfit, much like this Chinese buffet years ago in Arlington that I kid you not, on the if you read between the two windows, literally it was Red Chinese Plum Buffet. not Red Plum Chinese.
Damn it.
And we loved, oh, look, it's the Red Chinese Plum Buffet. That one, we talked about the names of the characters, because like Mr. Meaner was, you know, he suddenly became, you know, ultra intelligent. He said, just because you have a hyper intelligent brain doesn't mean you're good at coming up with names.
That's right. That's right. So as we come up on the end of the show, the one other thing I wanted to touch on was, we're starting to see, and I think it's due to the relative age of the new creators. You know, the breed that's in the editorial office now is roughly our age now, yeah. Where they used to be a lot older. You know, there was an old guard that stuck with kind of your standards. They would try to, you know, some kid would come in on a skateboard, you know, and pop off a skateboard and be like, "Hey, daddy-o, we need to update this with bomber jackets every once in a while in the 80s. Right. But, you know, generally it was just kind of your standard fare. Now we're starting to see this kind of sea change of bringing back characters that have been long forgotten, that might have been misused. I just saw, well, first of all, there's some really cool ones like Devil Dinosaur, Red Wolf. We've talked about him on the show where he's got a solo book, which I think is great. And also the one that shocks me to no end right now is with the new Marvel Now books and all the stuff they're doing. Solo. Do you remember Solo?
Oh my gosh! I haven't heard that name since before you were born.
Yeah, the one that wore all green, that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got his own. He's back for some ungodly reason. He's back. So Solo has returned to the Marvel Universe. But my question for you is. And I want to do this as a little bit of a improv game, and so our improv corner, the Hey Kids Comics improv corner. I want you. We need a theme song.
The theme music for.
Thank you. Improv. And this has been Hey Kids Comics Improv Corner.
Even that was improv.
I know. So I'm going to give you the name of a character that I would like personally to see come back. For to be revitalized, to be modernized, I guess, in a modern story. And I want you to pitch me your elevator speech. The story that you're going to have for this character.
How do I bring this character to life to address, to speak to today's
a modern audience? Right. So my choice for this for you, Cole. And now he's had an appearance fairly recently, but not in his form, in another form. But I want to know how you would bring Doc Samson up to date. I've always loved him. I thought it was a more cerebral character. I'd like to see him up to date in his own solo book. How would you pitch that?
What I see for Doc Samson, just like right off the top of my head, and hopefully we'll have time in a minute to tell everybody about the comic you mentioned to set this up to me earlier. That, you know, it's kind of unfair because I've had time to think about it.
Right.
But we'll get to that in a minute. For Doc Samson, what I see is literally, you know, to steal from ourselves, as it were, is a miniseries or even an ongoing series called The Doctor Is In.
Okay.
And what it is about is, you know, I think Peter David did a lot with the character from the standpoint of actually sitting down and psychoanalyzing.
Right.
I would like to see Doc Samson, that aspect of Doc Samson, challenged in conjunction with his superpowers.
Okay. I like that.
In a kind of forensic psychologist mode.
That would be awesome.
Kind of your two-fisted forensic psychologist mode, because inevitably, I guess is the word I'm looking for, is he's going to be drawn in to these cases that he's involved in, to the point where every now and again you need somebody who is either highly experienced in the realm of crime fighting, or you need somebody who can take a bullet in the same way most of us would, like, take a spitball.
Right. That's a really cool idea. So, like, almost like a Bones or a show like where – or a comic that would be – you know, he would be drawn in almost like an Ashley Judd or like a Silence of the Lambs type situation.
Exactly, where he's basically forced into. I really see it either as a mini series or a very finite type of series where you have this sort of. I would love to see a slow burn build.
Yeah.
Along the lines of, say, Starman.
Okay. Wow.
Where by the time you're good at five, this. 6 years awesome. In, you have, you know, you're getting chills at the end. You're like, my God, I've just been delivered a story with a definite beginning, middle, and end that took years to tell.
So are you thinking Dark, or are you thinking...
I think so. I think it's going to... What I see is sort of a being drawn into darkness.
Okay.
And clawing your way back out. Because I see Doc Samson as one of those characters who's never been challenged to that point, who is going to lose a tremendous piece of himself and have to fight to return to be that joyful, fun guy.
That's awesome. I would read the shit out of that comic.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful concept, but it has one great fallacy upon which it teeters and then falls off the edge into oblivion. Doc Samson is a Marvel character.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
End of story. It will never happen that way because it's Marvel.
That's true. But if you had control, that's the book you would make.
That was the book I would make. That was the book I would write.
I would read the shit out of that book. To be completely honest, that would be like something between, you know, Seven and like that's the vision that I have where he's in the mind of whoever, you know, he's gone so far down the rabbit hole that he's in the mind of I would read that.
And dealing with a character, an unexpected character like Carrion,
right?
Or, you know, God forbid, like Plant Man, for God's sake, you know, somebody that is the person of least interest.
I like it, dude. I like it. I think it's great.
The sort of thing where if it was DC, Batman, his first thought isn't going to be Tweedledee and Tweedledum. If suddenly they're the ones who snapped,
right? Right.
Finally realize their, albeit terrible, dark, and horrid potential.
Right. Holy, that's good. That's good. I like it.
So you see, like, the villain rising and the hero falling.
Right.
In that sense, you know.
That's good. I like it. We should pitch that to somebody.
Yes,
like,
indeed.
You feel free to use it, Marvel, but pay us. Pay Cole.
Yeah.
So I can keep doing a show. How about that?
There you go.
I'd like that. Do you have any that you want me to do? I would like to do one, if at all possible.
Honestly, I was just, you know, rattling things around in my head, and I thought, you know what would be, and I would love to see, what would the modern take be on Aquarian?
So which one was Aquarian? Refresh my memory.
Aquarian is the guy that looks like he just walked off the set of Godspell.
Oh my God, yes, yes.
Because otherwise, I was going to say he just like walked off of a passion play at a major church,
right?
One of those amphitheaters, and then changed into a disco outfit. And I realized, oh wait, that's Godspell.
That's just Godspell.
That's just Godspell. That's what that is.
How would I do Aquarian? So my thing about Aquarian is I think you might have hit the nail on the head there, in the sense that I would go new agey with him. Okay, that's the direction I would take this. Marvel character again, so it's kind of difficult, but I would definitely go new cult leader.
I would go
cult leader. I would do a cult comic where he almost like a Charles Manson-esque cult leader comic where he forms a cult because he's insane. Okay, so he's super charismatic, right? If I'm remembering right, he's super charismatic.
I think even if he wasn't, it plays well with the character because he looks. It occurs to me he'd be someone who is so invested in his own persona.
Right. Right.
That what you suggest is a perfect fit, even if it doesn't fit the character as it's ever been portrayed up to this point.
So, cult leader who's trying to wrest control or hold on to control as his cult is falling apart. The only thing, the Shyamalan twist is the idea is that he's pitching to his constituents that he is from another planet. And he's here to save them and save the planet from all of the civil wars, from all of the Thanos imperatives, from all the A Conquest of Annihilus, from all of the various conflicts, the constant superhero conflicts that are happening in their world. He's here to save them, and he finds, and because of that, because the air, because the idea that is so ripe for the picking, because all this is happening, and no one is addressing the common man. While this, it's almost become a Kingdom Come situation, where all these people are left with no representation, feeling like they aren't supported, that they don't have a say or a voice or a place to go. That he builds this massive following around this idea that he's the one to save them. The twist is, and this cult's falling apart because he can't get any traction with, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. or with the space UN or with, you know, S.W.O.R.D. or whoever it might be, that you know, he's starting to lose power, and there are usurpers of his throne coming in. But the Shyamalan twist to this is that he can save them. He has the power to save them. He could very easily do that, but no one believes him to be able to do that. So they just assume him as another... another
just
paper
another
tiger.
Kook, yeah.
Yeah. So that's my story, culminating in a great battle. You know, when S.H.I.E.L.D. comes Jim Jones style to his compound, or Koresh style to his compound, because they've been, you know, quote unquote, amassing inhumans, or amassing, you know, weapons, or amassing
gathering too many of the,
right,
without any oversight, without any leadership.
Right, that there's
the last thing in the world is you need is a Jim Jones Xavier.
Yeah, or Jim Jones with a gamma bomb, or Jim Jones that has made a deal with the High Evolutionary or Apocalypse to create more. You know what I mean?
Who knows? Yeah.
Right. So when the final confrontation happens and S.H.I.E.L.D. comes out to take him down, he, you know, it becomes a standoff. The last three issues of the comic are a standoff at his compound, where they keep bringing in more heavyweights, and he keeps bringing them down. But, he doesn't want to fight them. He wants to be able to live in peace away from these people. He's Aquarian.
Well, it becomes almost like, you know, Kane and Kung Fu, where where the hillbillies come to attack you and you just sort of brush them aside.
To the final showdown between maybe Sentry or Hyperion or another super, you know, Omega level character that ends up killing him, and that's when that's the emotional punch, is that this guy that all he wanted was to, you know, and it's told through his perspective instead of through the hero's perspective, so you kind of get a flip on the idea. It's a little darker. I think it's even as dark as your Doc Samson thing, because we're looking at it from a flipped angle, but I think it would tell a really interesting story about a group of people that's just trying to survive while all this chaos is happening, this condoned chaos is happening.
I can almost see the conclusion being the realization of his dream,
mm-hmm.
and then the revelation that, you know, you have this pitched battle, and then suddenly you're seeing the realization of Aquarian's dream. This
right.
utopia, this place that he has promised his flock. And it will seem just like so abrupt. Where the hell did that come from? And your final reveal, your big, what the twist is, that realization.
Right.
Is this death rattle.
Right.
You are seeing the ultimately from his own perspective, the last thoughts in his mind as he dies.
Well, and you know, and the idea is that, you know, you never that he's in any other given situation in a comic book, he'd be the bad guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you see the flip side of it in the comic, he's the bad guy. He's the guy that S.H.I.E.L.D.'s in the boardroom talking to the Avengers about. This guy's holed up somewhere in Louisiana. He's got a cult. He's got a bunch of superpower people there. Right.
And it's just going to do worse for us all if we don't do something quickly.
And we got to bring him down. Well, and then you turn the page and you get the Aquarian point of view, where he's literally just trying to, you know, he's teaching them how to farm and just trying to live life away from all this madness. And in the meantime, he's caught the eye of, you know, because he's been giving press conferences, he's gotten news coverage, and you know, that can't stand. You know, the aberration can't stand, and in the meantime, outside of the window of the Daily Bugle, Spider-Man's fighting Venom and wrecking buildings. You know, it's that, you know, and people are, there's, there are there are casualties there. You know, there's collateral damage, and that's what he's railing against. But that won't stand.
And it's a more meaningful death in the end than like Bruce Banner.
Right.
Well, spoiler alert.
Whoop. What? So there you go. That's mine. Now, which one did I pitch to you earlier?
Oh, what you had said to me earlier was to a revival, you know, just to come up with some characters we haven't heard from in a while or things like this. And you, by way of example, you had said, you know, like, for example, the title, Why the Last Man?
Oh, that's right.
And I have only a vague familiarity with that title. I actually remember reading and being rather impressed with it, rather surprisingly impressed with that, and then just not being able to get the rest of the issues.
It was great.
The rest of the
yeah.
trades. And off some, you know, vestigial memory, and the first thing that popped in my head when I read that, your email, and it said, Why the Last Man, was a revival miniseries called Why Not? N-A-U-G-H-T.
Why Not? I like it.
As a vehicle to bring the character, that world, and those adventures back to the forefront.
That would be such a cool idea.
And I see that as sort of why is still the intrinsically the it's almost like why beyond, because why is going to be a very important integral part of the story, but we're passing the torch of that story to another character.
Right.
As
right.
in like Batman Beyond.
That's awesome.
So you still have your, you know, your grizzled old Bruce Wayne, but you got a new guy coming in.
I like
it. You got some fresh blood. Now, I want to go and track down Why the Last Man, because I seem to remember being impressed by it.
And that was a little like punny on my part, because there's no way to revive that comic, because he was literally the last man. Like, that's the funny thing for me, is like, how are you going to retell that story in that universe that was existed in? He was the last man, and now he's dead. Well,
that's
bring back.
That's why you have Why Not.
That's right. There was one more man. Dormant man.
Who knew? Somebody, they finally moved that, opened that box in the back of the Rumpus Room. God damn it, there's another man.
There's one more man in there.
Thought we were dead. You know, it's always like that. You think you got it all, and
there's a song about that.
Who was selling comics and collectibles for years, you think you'd sold off the last or something, and damn it, if 5 years later, you don't dig another one up somewhere.
And speaking of digging another one up, it's time to bury this one.
Yes,
and we'll dig another
so
one up next
week.
There's
so much more to talk about that I felt in my heart we were never going to come remotely close, and that is more than borne out. I mean, I was looking over, Andrew does amazing research for this show, by the way, and I was looking over some of the research that just, like, we talked about one thing from your research.
Right!
And, of course, you know, there were things that we came to the table with without having to visit the internet to bring with us, and I want to put this out right now. July 2017, Salon des Refusés 2017.
I like it. Every year. I think this is good.
Every year we are going to revisit the Salon des Refusés, and we are going to pontificate all over the mother.
It keeps getting classier in here.
It does. Oh, it's kind of classy. It's classy in the town. We like to class it up a bit. You know, we got some people that are coming in. They want to see the town. You know, we kind of, you know, it's a little putting your silk hat on a pig, but who cares? You know, it's classing it up. So
why don't you plug us up? Well, first of all, what are we going to talk about next week?
I have.
That's perfectly fine.
We've probably talked about this before recently, that we are fully plotted well into the end of December.
Yeah, we are.
At this moment, if we haven't already crested, we may have already moved into January. In fact, as of tonight, we have established yet another story arc that probably won't see the light of day until January or February.
That's right. That's right. We keep coming up with ideas.
At least one, if not two more arcs before that one, plus another Hey Kids Comics team up. Well, God, so many things that we have coming up. I don't want to say which one it might be, because this may be one that's five issues away, but we actually have a schedule put together. It's amazing to me. You know, as you know, we already know what we're going to do for issue 300.
Right.
But, I can't believe we're pushing 200 issues already.
188 next week, man.
We will consult the runes and figure out where we were headed next. Sometimes we remember, sometimes we don't. But I can promise you it'll be a lot of fun here at the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
professional. Professional.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a professional. And you have to say that in a kind of lilty British voice that keeps changing from different characters.
I'm a professional.
But no idea what that was. Write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. Special thanks to Josh, who does amazing, has for years done an ever-evolving, ever-amazing Riddler cosplay, who will be joining us on a future episode, by the way.
Yes.
For writing in on... And also imparting to me in person, because I had not seen what he had written on the website about You Don't Mess with the Batmans. He was quite impressed. And thank you very much for actually letting me know in person. And no, you did not talk my ear off. I will not have you say that. So there was some brilliant stuff. And that is part and parcel why you have to be on the show, because you inspired an upcoming episode. And you can look for tweets at the Jedi Cole U on Twitter. And, of course, you can find myself, Nanny Medina, here and on watchonairlive.com the first and third Sundays of every month for the Rancor Pit Live. And here in July, we're not only going to be on the third Sunday, which is just a couple of days away, don't miss it, for a match made in Star Wars. But this is the 4th of July, so we will be back for the 5th Sunday as well, celebrating effectively our Dependence Day, which is the first and third Sunday of every month where we proclaim our dependence on Star Wars. So look for that, and you can also look for the YouTube channel for the Jedi Cole Universe, as well as the Rancor Pit has a committed YouTube channel with every surviving episode of the live show. Working on putting something together for Hey Kids Comics Live. If you never got a chance to see that, you can find those on Daily Motion. Be sure and check it out. For 9 months, Andrew and I were able to do a live version of this show, which was amazing. There are 10 episodes.
So much fun.
The last one was a farewell after Andy moved back to Ohio, making it not only practically but entirely impossible to do a live show because it was already a hell of a commute.
That's true. That's true.
Ohio to Dallas is that was too much to ask until they build that little capsule train where it spits you down a straw at 10,000 miles an hour.
Right.
And scrape your remains off the inside, hose it down, send it in for the next guy.
So
until that day, apologies to fans of the live show. Check it out. And coming very soon, if you've been following the Jedi Cole Universe website, it is my technological knuckle-dragging tour de force. It is about to look incredibly cool, thanks to none other than Andrew Farmer.
No. Come on. The only reason it's going to look cool is because there are like 400 articles and posts that are going to go up on there. And I would say probably 385 of those you posted. So I don't want to hear, nothing of the sort. But yes, we are working diligently on creating a new website with a lot of new features, modernized, updated. We aren't going to let this one fall to the wayside like your swordsman or your Doc Samson's. This one's coming back strong. This is our revival for technology.
Your Aquarians.
Now I want to see those comics. But yeah, so in closing, as always, buy, collect, and enjoy your comics. Go out and pick up the Marvel Universes. Especially because right now, everything is so malleable as far as, you know, canon and continuity goes. This gives you the, almost without question, the canon that the company wants you to go by. That's another cool thing about this, is they give you the origin right there. This isn't the internet, and nobody on Wikipedia can change it. This is in print. These things are amazing. Go read them. You'll love them. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody, and I will forewarn you that the description of how Cyclops and Colossus' power work in the original Marvel Universe is the most bizarre, ham-fisted science you will ever encounter. It makes no damn sense, but otherwise it's a damn fine series.
But that's why we love comics.
That's right.
All right, guys, we'll talk to you next week. Say good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
You were learning it. Was there something that made me come back again? And what could ever lead you?